I'm Mark Golub, and in the news, Peter Beinart's explosive piece, published in part in the New York Times, in which Peter explains why he's giving up on his long-championed two-state solution, and now believes that the fair and just thing for Israelis to do, and for world Jewry to do, is close down the sovereign Jewish state of Israel and create a new polity in which Jews and Palestinians would enjoy equal status and equal rights. Beinart's working name for this new polity is Israel-Palestine. In this new Israel-Palestine, Beinart makes it clear he wants the Jewish people to have a homeland where they can create a thriving Jewish society that both offers Jews refuge and enriches the entire Jewish world. But this homeland will not be a sovereign Jewish state. In Israel-Palestine, both Palestinians and Jews will be equal citizens of a sovereign polity extending from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. Now, Peter Beinart has been for decades the leading intellectual voice on the American Jewish left, criticizing Israel for its failure to implement a two-state solution, which Peter has argued for decades is the only way to ensure justice for both Jews and Palestinians, and to ensure that Israel remains a vibrant Jewish and democratic state, in keeping with its founding principles expressed in Israel's Declaration of Independence. You also know that Peter is a modern Orthodox Jew. His children have attended the Heschel Day School in Manhattan. He's a graduate of Yale, a Rhodes Scholar, and is the past editor of The New Republic. He's also appeared regularly as a pundit on CNN, and he's published three books, the most notable being The Crisis of Zionism. As a member of the left, if not the far left, in the Jewish community, Peter is aligned with such groups as J Street and New Israel Fund. His critique of Israel could be hailed by his supporters as just and prophetic, and his arguments and reasoning could be challenged by those who disagree with his characterization of the facts and with the conclusions he draws from them. But there was always one basic underlying premise to Peter Beinart's critique of Israel and in his call for a two-state solution. He was ardently committed to the existence and well-being of a sovereign Jewish state for the Jewish people, the State of Israel. His critics questioned this commitment, arguing that Peter and groups like J Street and New Israel Fund really were not at their core pro-Israel, but were committed to a more universalistic goal. And these critics now say, you see, we were right all the time. In the end, Peter Beinart is willing to sacrifice the Jewish state of Israel on the altar of some greater universalistic good. And as a result, there are those in the Jewish world who've come out in the strongest terms possible, criticizing Peter Beinart for betraying the state of Israel and the Jewish people. If you're a frequent viewer of JBS, you may have seen Alan Dershowitz offer his critique of Peter's new position, as well as Daniel Gordis, who actually did a podcast series with Peter debating Israeli policy, debates which the two also did before live synagogue and college audiences. We actually televised one of those debates from Temple Beth El's Hoffman Lecture Series in Stamford, Connecticut. But on JBS, Daniel Gordas was sad to say that he feels Peter Beinart has crossed a red line by proposing an end to the Jewish state of Israel. Well, there are those who now feel that Peter Beinart has forfeited his right to any mainstream platform in the Jewish community. And I understand where this feeling comes from. There may be those of you who now watch JBS and think Peter should not be given a voice on JBS. But in the context of this controversy, I feel that Peter has every right to explain why he is now willing to see an end to the state of Israel, which he has been so devoted to until now. And so we reached out to Peter the day his piece appeared in the New York Times. By the way, Peter's entire piece was first printed in the progressive Jewish magazine and news site called Jewish Currents, for which Peter is now editor at large. But we reached out to Peter and invited him to come on JBS to explain his dramatic decision to abandon his commitment to the Jewish state of Israel. And I'm pleased now to say that Peter is now with us. Peter, thank you so much for joining us on JBS.
My pleasure.
So, Peter, what I hope you can discuss is what in the world motivated you not simply to give up on this two-state solution, but to give up on the Jewish sovereign state. And as you've been an outspoken critic of Israeli policy vis-a-vis the Palestinians for a decade, you outline in detail why you support this new polity called Israel-Palestine. And people can agree with you or disagree with you. But that's not the issue. The issue is that you consciously chose to do something you wrote about in your very first opening paragraph, where you say, in most Jewish communities on earth, rejecting Israel is a greater heresy than rejecting God. So why, Peter, did you decide to reject Israel?
Thanks. As you know, I have supported the two-state solution for my entire adult life, and I've really pleaded with others to try to stop the process of settlement growth that was making a sovereign, viable Palestinian state impossible. But I fail. Despite my efforts and the efforts of others, the settler population in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, which in the early 1980s, Meron Benveniste, the former deputy mayor of Jerusalem, said if it reached 100,000, a viable Palestinian state would be impossible. It is now around 650,000, not by accident, but because the Israeli government has essentially made it cheaper for Israeli Jews to live in that territory. Two of Israel's Supreme Court justices now live in the West Bank. Its newest medical school is in the West Bank. Its second most powerful politician, arguably, Avigdor Lieberman, lives in the West Bank. I have spent a lot of time in the West Bank, and I would plead with your viewers who have not had the opportunity to do so themselves, to do so on the next time they're lucky enough to go to Israel-Palestine. I have stood in villages that are slated for demolition, where every building in that village is going to be bulldozed, not because people have done anything wrong other than they don't have permits that as non-citizens they can't get. And so for me, when I came to the very reluctant conclusion that a viable, contiguous, sovereign Palestinian state is no longer possible, and that it is morally unacceptable to hold millions of people without basic rights. And since Israel has foreclosed on the possibility of a Palestinian state, that I had to think about alternatives that I believed could both give Palestinians the basic human rights that they as human beings deserve and also allow for the vibrant Jewish society that I believe must be maintained in the land of Israel.
Let me just take one element, because I understand exactly how you feel about Israel's failure. And I've tried to acknowledge it. And you know, again, Peter, people agree with you or disagree with you. And that's the interesting quality about you. You know, you and I have done two L'chaims, one alone when you came out with the book, Crisis of Zionism. Then you did a debate sort of with Thane Rosenbaum. You know,
right.
I've been to many of your lectures. You and I have been together many times. It's not that we're social friends, but it's very, I think very highly of you and I enjoy you. But the things
like
you've said right now that you are critical of, saying to viewers, you know, I wish you would go on the West Bank. You've said that. On L'chaim, you've said it. You've said it in lectures all the time. There's nothing new in your encouraging people to see what you consider to be Israel's shortcomings is not a strong enough word for you. You describe brutality. You describe a lack of democracy. You've been very, but you've always been very critical. The one thing you haven't ever done is in some way, you know, cross the line.
Right.
And you write this also, and then I'll give you a chance to answer.
Sure.
You write, questioning Israel's existence as a Jewish state is akin to spitting in the face of people I love and betraying institutions that give my life meaning and joy. Besides, Jewish statehood has long been precious to me, so I've respected certain red lines. You realize you made a conscious choice in the context of things you've been critical of your entire public career. The difference here is you have decided to cross a red line to, using your imagery, to spit in the face of the Jewish community. And I said to myself, you know, I know you. I understand you philosophically. It surprised me, given your passion up till now, for the existence of a sovereign Jewish state. You always argued Israel must be better. Israel must care for the Palestinian. It's unacceptable for the state of Israel, from your perspective, to give rights to Jews in Israel that are not given to everybody, most specifically the Palestinians. But you've always done that within a context of a sovereign state of Israel. Is there a way for you to explain to me and the audience, something happened inside you where you said, I still feel what I feel, but somehow I am ready to spit in the face of people I love? That's what I want to understand, Peter.
So I guess there are two ways of answering that. There's an intellectual way and an emotional way, right? And you are gesturing at both. Emotionally, I would say, first of all, I try to anchor myself in a sense of myself as a Jew that is stands outside of this conversation, or what are the norms in our in any particular community that I'm a part of, right? I wake up, and many others do, I wake up, I pray, I put on tefillin, I study Talmud every morning. I feel rooted in a Jewish conversation, which is much bigger than the norms of what is accept, what is treif and what is kosher in 2020 in one particular synagogue, right? I mean, our peoplehood, our conversation, our Judaism is much deeper than that, right? The norms change over time. Secondly, you know, and maybe this is the result of having grown up and spent a lot of my childhood in apartheid South Africa. And of course, there are important differences between Israel, Palestine, and apartheid South Africa, some of which I write about. But I will say that it imprinted upon me as a child the sense that morally, we are all going to be judged, that we will be judged, and that the history renders its moral verdict. And I ultimately believe, I could be wrong, I've been wrong about many things, but I can only do what I think is right. I can't know what's right, you know, universally. I can just do what I think is right. I believe that we will be judged for the oppression of millions of Palestinians who lack basic rights. I believe for a long time that there would be a solution to that, that it would allow the creation of a Palestinian state. It would mean that all of these stateless non-citizens whose suffering I have seen, just a tiny little bit of it, I've seen myself, and it has brought me to my knees, that there would be a way of solving part of that problem with the creation of a Palestinian state. But events move. Things happen. I was arguing this for 10 years. Over that 10 years, the settler population, not just the numbers, but the deep infrastructure of Israeli control has been deepened and deepened and deepened. And so at a certain point, I was making these arguments and I began to think, I'm not convincing myself that a two-state solution is possible. Almost all the people I know who really know reality on the ground have come to the conclusion that a viable Palestinian state, not something that doesn't have a capital in East Jerusalem, doesn't control the Jordan Valley, is under security control, that's not a state. An actual state have come to the conclusion that this is not possible. And the switch, and I was at a dead end. I was at a dead end. And so I began to read. I began to read a lot of writing by Palestinians and Jews about one integrated space. I began to read a lot of writing about the way other conflicts have changed. And I began to read a lot about the history of Zionism. And I came to the conclusion that the core of my identification, my solidarity, my love, was not actually a Jewish state, but it was a Jewish society. As I call in the piece, a Jewish home. In this, I've been influenced by people like Achad Ha'am. You know, Achad Ha'am was probably the second most important Zionist thinker after Theodor Herzl. He didn't believe in a Jewish state. He believed in a Jewish society. And I make the argument in my piece. One could certainly, people can disagree with me. Yeah, God knows I'm not infallible. But my argument is that a vibrant Jewish society that provides refuge and rejuvenation is absolutely possible within either a confederation or one equal state. And that the path that Israel is on, if it continues down the current path of entrenching its control in the West Bank, will lead us to very, very dark places, perhaps another act of mass expulsion and violence and war that will ultimately be terrible, not just for Palestinians, but will ultimately be terrible for Israeli Jews.
Okay, but what you said, intellectual and emotional. Do you feel you've described both?
Yes.
Okay. I have a couple of reactions.
Please.
And again, you know, to my audience, I refuse to vilify. I happen to disagree with Peter, but again, I've known him a long time, and what, you know, there are people, Peter, who've said, oh, they're cynical. Why did Peter do this? Because Peter really wants to draw attention to himself. He, you know, this is all about press. And I said, that's nonsense. Then you don't know who Peter Beinart is. Whatever else you are, wrong or right, I have always respected the passion with which you've taken a stand. And I believe you want the best for the Jewish people, the State of Israel, the Palestinians. I believe that. And people, if people think I'm naive, I don't care.
Thank you.
But I've also said to you, or I've been honest with you where I disagree with
right.
you.
Yeah,
when you
yeah.
say to me, for example,
yeah.
some of this comes out of your Talmudic study.
Mm-hmm.
The Talmudic, the paramount Talmudic mm-hmm. principle,
mm-hmm.
the ultimate ethic in the Talmud is pikuach nefesh.
Yeah,
that ultimately
absolutely.
Every other law is set aside to save life.
Right.
And part
right.
of the problem now, and it is intellectual and maybe it's emotional
right.
too, Peter,
right.
is
right.
that for many people, they understand the Jewish tradition to say the first concern we have is for the Jewish people
mm-hmm.
and that it doesn't stop there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jews who let it stop there
mm-hmm.
are not understanding the Jewish tradition. And the
right.
Hillel line is often used yeah. to explain the complicated way in which all human beings live. You must be compared,
yeah.
you must be
yeah.
concerned for yourself,
yeah.
but it can't
yeah.
end there.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
feeling we have now is
yeah. Yeah.
that there has been a subtle shift in your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Where at the one point, on the one hand,
mm-hmm.
you would have said again so much of the same things today
mm-hmm.
had I Had you and I had this conversation 2 months ago,
sure.
five
sure.
months ago, the exact same thing. The one difference is you would have also said, but there must be a Jewish state that thrives and survives. In that context, you would then say certain things are incumbent upon that Jewish state, but they're secondary. It seems the flip in your thinking has now been there is some greater universal value and goal, which I respect. My sense is that most Israelis, you and I might, we might disagree, most Israelis are in fact sympathetic to the Palestinians. I speak to Israeli after Israeli, and in polls, they don't hate Palestinians. They, and nothing would make Israelis happier than if their children and grandchildren no longer had to serve in the IDF, in Hebron, or on the Gaza border, and that would be peace between Israel and Palestinians. But that ultimately, the greatest good is the good of a Jewish state, what it's done for the Jewish people, what it says about Jewish history, and what it says about Pikuach Nefesh, and it's not about the Holocaust for me at all. And you make that point very strongly in your piece. But it is about Jewish self-determination, which I believe the Jew has no less than the Palestinian, no more, but no less. And it seems that your switch is that there is now something greater in your value system than a state of Israel, a sovereign Jewish polity where Jewish life is worked out in all of its, you know, grandeur, Peter, and all of its disappointing ugliness. Speak to that.
Right. So I understand that it could come across as that I am a pure universalist who cares no more for Jewish welfare than I do for Palestinian welfare or the welfare of anybody else. You know, Rosa Luxemburg notoriously said, you know, I care no more for the masses of Jews of Eastern Europe than I do for the oppressed people in Madagascar. That is not who I am. That is not the way I see it. I understand. I can't be responsible for the way people perceive me. They're going to perceive me the way I am. But I see the Jewish people as an extended family. That in the book of Bereshit, that we tell the story of a family, and in the book of Shemot, in slavery, that family becomes a nation, becomes a people. B'nai Yisrael, Am Yisrael. If I believed that in one equal framework, again in a confederation or a federated state, that Jews that Pikuach Nefesh would be threatened, that Jews would be in physical danger, I would not advocate this position. At the core of my contention, one of the central contentions of my piece is that oppression breeds violence. That Israel is a binational state. It controls all the territory between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, even Gaza. I can explain that if you want to talk more about it. And therefore, what we know about binational states is that binational states that hold millions of people without basic rights are more violent, more unstable. I believe that we have been lulled into a false sense of complacency by the fact that for 15 years, the Palestinian Authority has been helping Israel keep things quiet, but that Israel is headed towards intifada after intifada because the violence of oppression breeds violence, and that violence will rebound back on the Jewish state. So I believe that you can think that I'm the craziest person in the world, but my contention is that Jews, this will be better for Jews as well as Palestinians. And if I only thought it would be good for Palestinians, but not good for Jews, I would not advocate it because I would never knowingly advocate something that I felt was going to be bad for the Jewish people. I could be wrong, but I would never knowingly advocate such a position.
Okay. And by the way, you say it from your perspective very well. People should just hear you. They don't have to agree with you, and you already said that yourself. Again, I'm only going to repeat myself. You know what? I want to ask you about another criticism you took.
Please.
And whether it was in some way a portend of this. You took criticism over giving Omar Barghouti, the founder of the BDS movement, who advocates the destruction of Israel. A platform at NYU where you permitted him to speak unchallenged. Was this because you were already thinking that there should be Israel proper, that there should be this Israel-Palestine?
No, I had not taken that view at that point, and I wouldn't say that he was unchallenged. I think I asked him some actually pretty tough questions. I want to start by saying something about the language. When we say that Omar Barghouti wants the destruction of Israel, right? I think for most people, when they hear that, what they think of is violence, especially given our trauma. When you use the word destruction, right, the notion is, even subconsciously, that what someone like Omar Barghouti is suggesting is that basically there should be some violent attack. Omar Barghouti and I don't agree on everything. We didn't agree then. I don't think we agree now on everything. But what Omar Barghouti is calling for is one state with equality, right? I don't think that the word destruction is the appropriate word when someone is calling for equality, when someone represents a group of people who right now are denied basic freedom. So I talked to Omar Barghouti, as I would also happily talk to Moritz Klein. I believe in talking to people that I disagree with. I believe, as it says in Pirkei Avot, who is wise, the one who learns from all people. And I believe, as you know, because I say this ad nauseum, so forgive me for saying it again, is that we are impoverished as a Jewish community when we do not speak to and listen to Palestinians more. And so I was trying to model that.
By the way, I'm going to give you a quote, and I understand that you're saying when people use the word destruction, it implies violence.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to use any word you want that means there's no more Israel. Barghouti has said definitely, most definitely, we oppose a Jewish state in any part of Palestine. No Palestinian. Rational Palestinian. Let me finish. Rational Palestinian.
Yes.
Not a sellout Palestinian would ever accept a Jewish state in Palestine. Now, he may not mean physical violence, but he does mean the end of the Jewish state. And now you mean the end of the Jewish state.
Right. Yes, that's true. But again, if you were a Palestinian, and either living under a Jewish state as a non-citizen or as a second-class citizen, wouldn't you also want equality? Right. I mean, is this something? Why do we think of this as some crazy pathological desire? People want to be equal. It's a very deep human desire. I don't think it makes Omar Barghouti an anti-Semite.
You're absolutely right, but you're conflating two things. Mm-hmm. Most Jews passionately want as much equality as we can have in life. By the way, equality is hard to come by in every society. Mm-hmm. But the ideal of the Israeli, the ideal of the Israeli society is, I believe, very much consistent with what you want. The question and the shift in you is that at one point you argued, again, every single thing you're telling me now, with one slight change. You wanted it to happen from within Israel. And now you're acting as if it can't happen unless there is no Israel.
Right, but this is because, and again, I don't think that most of the critics of my piece, and maybe I've missed some of the criticisms, but I don't think most of the critics of my piece have engaged with the central empirical proposition, which I start with, which is to say that it is no longer feasible to create a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, right? It's not as if I didn't just wake up one morning and change my views because I got up on the wrong side of the bed. I changed my views because realities on the ground have changed. The prospect of actually creating a viable Palestinian state, I can't say it's impossible because you can never say any historical eventuality is impossible. Austro-Hungarian Empire could return. But the chances of it now being created are extraordinarily slim. And so I then become potentially complicit in essentially giving a hecture to the status quo, a status quo that I believe is morally unacceptable.
Okay. My last question for you.
Yeah.
You've seen people say, by the way, if you quote your own article, You understand, I'm using that the image is a powerful image. You're a great writer, by the way, Peter. So you write,
Appreciate
this spitting image. It's like spitting at people I love. And there are people now who are going to have a very hard time believing you should have a platform because you have crossed a red line. You've crossed a red
Some of
line
them
for
have
infant.
emailed
I'm sorry?
me. Some of them have emailed me to let me know
I am sure that's true.
that.
I want to know how you feel about that. And yeah, how does Peter, how do you, you've given your life to this, Peter. You're a committed Jew. You're just, people think you're on the wrong side. And I think you're wrong. But at the moment,
I
you've
know.
put yourself in a position where it's going to be very hard for you to have the same kind of platform that you used to have. How do you feel about that?
Look, I, for me, if there's another Jewish person in the world who sees me as an enemy, and sees me as someone who hates Jews, who doesn't care about what Jew the welfare of Jews, that for me is a tragedy, because it means that I failed in what I was trying to do, which was be a loving critic. And one of the things that I try whenever I can, I just spent earlier today an hour on the phone with a guy who had been criticizing me on Twitter, and we decided to have an hour-long conversation. It ended up being a beautiful conversation. I would say, to the extent that I have time in my day aside from spending time with my kids, if there are viewers who want to reach out to me and want to have a genuine conversation, no Jewish person is alien to me. No Jewish person is my enemy. But at the end of the day, I believe that although someone's anger and rage and betrayal matters to me, the thing that matters to me most is the belief that I will be judged, that I will be judged. I will be judged by God, and maybe I'll be judged by my grandchildren. And to me, that's the most sacred task, is to try to make sure that I have done as good a job as being as true to my belief about what's right as possible. I may be wrong, but I have to be true to what I believe.
Yes, you do, and you always are. And what I'm about to say may sound harsh. I don't mean it as harsh. I just mean it as honest as you're trying to be.
Please.
It may very well be that one day your grandchildren and your God will judge you very harshly for giving up on the state of Israel. And
It's possible.
I understand what you want out of Israel. And again, the disagreements we have are not on goal. The disagreements are on what are the facts on the ground. And you have the right to argue that as vociferously as you can, and so does Mort Klein. Good for you. And to your credit, Peter, you'll come on with Mort Klein. And there are some people who won't come on with Mort Klein. But in the end, the real problem here for me, and I hope this is not the last time, not that you're on JBS, but that you and I have a chance to think this specific issue through, is what you want in the most ideal sense. People will argue, Peter, with you, it's not achievable. I didn't want to go there at all. I don't want to discuss the details. The only real issue here is Peter Beinart no longer believes there should be a state of Israel. And ultimately, I hope maybe in the future, you and I will have a chance if you, as that, if that evolves in you any further, I really want you to discuss it with me because it is the most important issue you are now representing. It casts you in a certain light in the Jewish world. And it also raises a very interesting questions, which, Peter, people are going to be talking about. Anyway, I give you enormous credit for coming on JBS to speak with me. You knew how strongly I disagree with you. And I want to say again, while I think you've made a grave mistake and have indeed crossed the red line, which is red for a very good reason, I enjoy you on a personal level. I wish you and your family only good health. And
Thank you.
all good things, Peter. And I hope you one day will come and discuss your position even further with me on JBS.
I would love to do that. I would love to do that.
Thank you. You be well.
Thank you. You well.
The thoughts of Peter Beinart. I hope you're glad you had a chance to hear him. on JBS, even if you wish he didn't have a platform. If he has a platform like this, where somebody can really ask him over and over again, why did you do this, Peter? And I understand his answer, but it does not resonate with me at all. And I also hope you appreciate that on JBS, you've had the chance to hear Peter Beinart, Alan Dershowitz, Daniel Gordis address headline news in the Jewish community. And again, I hope overall it's helped put your own thinking into perspective. As always, my thanks to our director, Sloan Copeland, JBS's managing director, Dara Golub, transmission manager, John McDevitt, and to the producer of In the News, Carol Lilienthal. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Stay safe and be well, my friends.